You got some?
Just before we start, Michael's got a handout there, which we'll hand out. It's a breakdown of the Book of Romans, which is a Bible insert. So if we have it before we start, it'll save us breaking into our study as we go along. Well, brethren and sisters, I do believe that in the mercy of God, should we have the opportunity of continuing for a full year prior to the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, that we do have set before us in our ecclesial activities this year an outstanding, absolutely outstanding set of studies. The only limiting factors will be the ability of the speakers to present the material or the ability of any of us in the audience to be able to perhaps find enough time to go into the depth that we would desire. But one thing is certain, that the studies themselves couldn't be better. Our theme for the year, Rejoice in Hope of the Glory of God, is of course taken directly from the Book of Romans. We've already started our complementary study, which is the study of the Book of Revelation, and we look forward, God willing, to our ecclesial camp, when all of these three activities will focus our attention on this absolutely vital theme of the manifestation of the glory of God in our lives. And what better theme that as we went through Romans chapter 1 this evening, and we came to that shocking situation which existed as described in the latter part of Romans chapter 1, that we see there a description not of the Roman world of 2,000 years ago, but of the very world of today. This is the world in which our children are being brought up. It's a world in which people, even what we would call decent people in the world, are now accepting things which 10 years ago even indecent people in the world wouldn't have accepted. And so what better situation can we find ourselves in than studying these two books, Revelation and Romans? We had cause to point out in our opening study day that both of these studies can be considered by people to be quite deep. Our brother Norm made the comment in his opening remarks that it's been described as the profoundest book in the world. I suspect he may have been doing some preparatory reading, because that's the very opening sentence the brother Carter has in his book on the Epistle to the Romans. The letter to the Romans has been described as the profoundest book in the world. No, that's all right, I wasn't going to quote it. But what I was going to say was that as background reading, this is basically really the only reference book that is generally available. There were some notes that went through the Logos magazine several years back. So if you do have Logos magazines, I forget what the actual date was now, but it's getting back a few years, you will find some verse-by-verse notes in there. But I think Brother Carter's book, The Letter to the Romans, which is still available in the library, comes in a paperback cover, I think, generally nowadays, is considered to be a very good basic text. And we would therefore suggest that as an introduction to the class each night, if you're able to read through the relevant section in there, it's not intensive and it can be covered quite easily. So what we've got set before us then is in fact a letter which has been described as the profoundest book in the world, but God gives us these books to understand them. And that, I believe, is going to be the challenge that's going to face, well, this particular class studying the Book of Romans. I rather like that sort of challenge, because I think that if a book appears to be difficult, then it's a matter of going about it in a way by which it can be made easy. The Book of Romans does have some very intense and very complicated reasoning in it, reasoning which is made much more difficult because most of us, in fact all of us, are quite unfamiliar with the background. We know from just doing the daily readings in Romans that sometimes Paul puts up a question and then answers the question. Most of us have difficulty even understanding the question, let alone understanding what the answer was. And so those are the things which we will endeavour to unravel. The history of Romans classes in the ecclesias have not always been all that good. Whilst I believe excellent matter has been presented on many occasions in many ecclesias, many brethren and sisters have felt that the studies have got bogged down. I have never led an ecclesial class on Romans, although I've done the study personally. I think there is a solution to this, And it will be our desire, therefore, not to get too heavily involved in much of the reasoning which is perhaps ancillary to the main theme, but to endeavour to pick up the main themes and to deal with those themes in quite some intensity. Certainly themes like the atonement are dominant through the whole of the book, the theme of the righteousness of God. And therefore the intervening reasoning that goes between it can be treated, I believe, in somewhat of a narrative form. Now that doesn't mean we'll be skipping over it, but we're not necessarily going to get heavily involved and bogged down in word-by-word analysis of the reasoning. The other thing which we will endeavour to do as we go through is to note particularly Paul's use of Old Testament scriptures. So this will enable us then to enhance our understanding of many Old Testament books. Because as we know, when a New Testament writer quotes from the Old, he invariably gives us an insight into that Old Testament book which we never saw before. So that's what we're going to endeavour to do. There are several things that we're going to endeavour to do. The first one would be basically to study Romans, doing a character study of the Apostle Paul as we go through. Now that doesn't mean to say that we've got to necessarily look at his life, but we're going to look particularly at the thinking of Paul as it comes out in many of his writings. And that essentially is what we're going to be doing tonight. We're only going to be looking at the salutation tonight, the opening few verses, but we're going to consider it in the light of Paul's salutation in the other epistles he wrote, to see first of all the mind of the man, but also to see the way in which he went about writing different things to different people. So the studies will be an analysis of, you might say, Paul himself. We're going to have a look at certain dominant themes, principally surrounding the atonement. We're going to endeavour also to pick up the Old Testament passages which are quoted. But over and above all of these things, brethren and sisters, there is one thing which is going to come out preeminently, and that is a consideration of Jesus Christ. Now that statement had a lot of intensity in it, much more than perhaps you appreciate it. Let me explain it in these words, and I know you won't misunderstand what I'm saying. As a community, we concentrate very much on God, and rightly so. The churches about us virtually worship Jesus. They do that because they see him as God the Son, and therefore, if you're going to worship God, you can just as easily worship Jesus. There is, though, I think, a sense in which at times we relegate Jesus to a somewhat unimportant position. We treat him more as a concept rather than as a person. If you think this is an unfair criticism, then just rule it out. But this is a feeling I get, that whilst we talk about God manifestation, which after all is the dominant theme, we then sort of relate ourselves directly to God and say, well, of course, we're related to God through Jesus. But what the study of Romans does is that it elevates Jesus into his proper position, not an improper position. But I think it may, in some of our minds, reinstate him to perhaps a higher position than some of us have at times perhaps given him. And of course that chart is excellent, isn't it? Because that chart is the focal point of God's purpose. And when you look at that chart, there's one thing you see. It's Jesus Christ. We know that God is the invisible I will be up in that top left-hand corner. But it is the visible who I will be in the middle there, which is the theme of the book of Romans. And that's going to come out powerfully in these opening verses tonight. So we are really going to be studying Jesus Christ. Not Jesus Christ as he appears in the Gospels, but Jesus Christ as he is in God's purpose. He is the manifestation of God. He is the representative of man. And we're going to see him in that light, not just as a concept, but as a person who lived on this earth and who is now living in heaven. And I think perhaps if we just leave that point at that, our subsequent studies hopefully will enlarge and amplify the particular point that I'm making there, and you may perhaps be able to re-echo with me the sentiments which I've expressed, that there may be occasions where, because of a fear of almost treating Jesus as God the Son, almost talking of it as a Trinity, that maybe we relegating very much to the Son of Man theme, and we don't see the importance also of the Son of God theme. Well, that's an idea of some of the things we're going to be looking at in the book. So you can see, even though we talk in terms of keeping it simple, there are a number of different themes, aren't there? And so I suppose in that sense, a study can be made complex. I don't mean by complex difficult. All I mean is that there could be two or three subsidiary themes that we might be considering as we're going through. Well, I think without any further ado, let's go straight into the Epistle to the Romans. You always study the background to a book. And as far as Romans is concerned, there doesn't appear to be any background to the book. It doesn't appear to have been written to combat any particular problem in Rome. Paul hadn't visited Rome, although it was his intention to visit Rome, and it would appear that the letter was written to prepare the way for his arrival by outlining the great issues that the truth had faced in the Roman world. So Paul had travelled extensively throughout the Roman world, but almost his last port of call was to be Rome itself. And so as he deals with the issues that he struck in various parts of the Roman world, he is able to write to this ecclesia in Rome that, as far as he was concerned, had been largely untouched by these issues, but that undoubtedly Rome, being the centre of the empire, the capital of the empire, would one day experience them. And so really, I think Paul enjoyed writing this letter because he was able to write it in an uncomplicated environment. You take the last of the epistles, the epistle which Jude wrote. Jude said, look, I wanted to write a certain type of epistle to you. I wanted to talk about our common hope. But unfortunately, I couldn't. The problems were so great that I had to urge you to contend for the faith. And I had to write a different sort of epistle. Romans, in fact, is the very epistle that Jude probably would have liked to have written. An epistle which is all about our common hope. And I believe, brethren and sisters, this is the reason why the Epistle to the Romans is the first of the epistles in the New Testament. We've got Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. We've got the Acts of the Apostles. And in the inspired assembly of the book, and I believe that God's hand was in the assembly of the New Testament, Romans is undoubtedly the first and the foremost of the epistles. Because in it, Paul is able to speak about the gospel of Christ. The gospel of God, which is powerful unto salvation, and to show to us how it is powerful in the lives of every individual, be they a Jew or a Greek. And so our study can and will be undertaken independent of the background. So we're not going to try and concoct a background. We simply say that Paul had not visited there. He wasn't aware specifically of problems there, but he was able to prepare the people for his coming, and in so doing, as some would style it, he laid down a thesis. A thesis sounds to me a very, very academic and sort of theoretical word. But really that's what he's done. He said, look, this is the gospel that I've preached, and these are some of the problems that we've struck along the way. Well, let's have a look at the structure of the book. I'm going to put up an overhead transparency, and this overhead transparency will be read in conjunction with the little Bible insert that we've all got. The Bible insert, incidentally, is a breakdown of the book. I didn't do this particular one. I'm not in fact sure who exactly did, but I think really it is taken from Brother Carter's breakdown anyway. And when we look at it, it's a logical one. I don't think there's any real argument about the breakdown of the book. We'll have a look at it in just a moment after we've had a look at this overview. So perhaps if we put sort of one eye on the screen and occasionally look back at that just to see how the two are connected together, this will explain it in a more readable sort of way at this stage. Following the introductory salutation, which we find in the first 15 verses of chapter 1, Paul sets forth the truth from a doctrinal standpoint, showing how it relates to salvation. Man is under condemnation, and thus he must seek salvation through the process of three steps: justification,
That is, he must be declared righteous. Sanctification, that is, he must be separate, both constitutionally separated from the world and separated morally. And then finally, he must be glorified. That section extends from chapter 1, verse 16, to chapter 8, verse 39. And in fact, if you look at that at the Bible insert, you'll see that there are in fact those three sections there. They may have slightly different words here, but the section which we call justification would be the section chapter 1, verse 18 to chapter 3, verse 20, entitled Man's Failure to Attain to Righteousness. The next section, which has been styled sanctification, would be the section from chapter 3, verse 21 to 5, verse 21, the righteousness of God revealed. And finally, the idea of a glorification would be the third section from chapter 6, verse 1 to chapter 8, verse 39. So there are the three stages: justification, sanctification, and glorification. And you would probably guess where that breakdown came from, even if you didn't know. That was taken from Brother Mansfield's analysis in the Logos notes. You can usually pick them up because the words either end the same or start the same. And that's the clue. Nevertheless, I think they're very appropriate words. Our note goes on to say, then follows the national aspect of the gospel, how it relates to Israel. We've got three sections. Chapters 9, 10 and 11 are quite clearly defined. We've got Israel as the selected nation. Why did God select Israel? Then chapter 10, we've got Israel, the rejected nation. Why did God reject Israel? And then chapter 11 says God will ultimately restore them. So chapter 11 is Israel, the restored nation. So chapter 9, Israel, the selected nation. Chapter 10, Israel, the rejected nation. And chapter 11, Israel, the restored nation. And all of those are contained under that section 3D, the righteousness of God in relation to Israel. Then, as our note says, we come to the practical side of the epistle, dealing with our social responsibilities in chapter 12, our civil responsibilities in chapter 13, our ecclesial responsibilities in chapter 14 through to chapter 15, verse 13, and then finally he concludes with personal messages in chapter 15, verse 4 to chapter 16, verse 27. So that's the structure. On the surface, it doesn't appear to be a simple structure. I make no bones about the fact, brethren and sisters, I have found, and I would still say I find Romans a difficult book. Some people naturally relate to the reasoning in Romans. Not many people do. Most people find it a difficult book. I think that's good, therefore, if the study leader does find it difficult, because then he identifies better with his audience and he's not talking over their head. So hopefully we'll be at about the same level. But that doesn't mean to say that I haven't come to a reasonable understanding of it. I believe I've been very thrilled with what I've come to an understanding of, but it isn't easy. So what we will endeavour to do is to, as we go through it, try to see how there is a flow of argument going through these things. Because looking at it as it would appear there, either on the screen or with our breakdown, you might say, well, I can't see a nice, simple flow going through. Like, for example, the breakdown in Galatians has an obvious flow of doctrinal and expositional and exhortational, or Ephesians, a doctrinal and a practical section, or a Colossians, a doctrinal and a practical section. All seems very simple. Here, it doesn't seem to flow quite so smoothly. But hopefully, if we do get around to finishing the book, by the time we've got to it, we will have seen the way in which there is a theme flowing through, and we will agree that it's profound. That it's not the sort of thing you see right at the outset. You see, if we were to pull most of other Paul's epistles just out of there and say, give us a breakdown of Philippians, we could put it up there and people would say, oh, that sounds logical. But Romans isn't quite like that. And that's what makes it a profound book. Well, this evening, we're going to concentrate more on Paul. Because some of you have done studies of other letters which Paul has written, and we'll get you to help out during the course of the night. I think it's a very, very important thing to see the way in which Paul himself set about the important task he had of not just writing to Romans, but to many individuals and ecclesias throughout the Roman world. And I think it's very important to get some insight into the mind of the writer right from the beginning. What I want to do then at the moment is to simply have a look at the opening salutation, you know, the way in which he addressed his readers. And what we're going to do for a few moments is we're going to have a look at every one of the letters which Paul wrote and just briefly compare the difference between the way in which he introduced himself to each of the individuals or ecclesias to which he wrote and see what lesson comes out of that particular analysis in itself. I've got a transparency here which may not be all that readable, I don't know. It's not too bad. But even if it can't be read, it doesn't really matter, because what I've done on this transparency is simply to type out the salutation of each of the letters that Paul wrote. And so you can pick it up quite easily from the scriptures itself. What we've done is we've gone from Corinthians, in fact we've left Romans till last. Just let's have a quick scan down the screen here. We've gone from Corinthians through to Hebrews, and then we've packed Romans on the end. Sorry if you can't see Romans down the bottom at the moment, but it is down there. Just get a quick look at the size of the salutation. Just how much of the letter is taken up with his greeting. Just pick them at random for the moment. First of Corinthians. Paul, called to be an apostle of Jesus Christ through the will of God, and Sosthenes, our brother. That's the stop, because he then goes on to say to the Corinthians or to those that are in Corinth or something like that. So I've stopped at the moment that he then says who he's speaking to. So how has he addressed himself? He always addresses, and we don't do that, do we? When we stand up here, when Norm stands up, he doesn't say, I, brother Norm Lloyd, and then he puts behind himself whatever particular ecclesial office he thinks is appropriate to his work as a presider, and then go on and speak about it. He doesn't do that, but Paul does. He always speaks about some aspect of his work, and it's always going to be relative to the theme, or relevant to the theme, about which he's going to write. So when he writes to the Corinthians, he says, Paul, called to be an apostle of Jesus Christ through the will of God, Sosthenes, our brother. The second of Corinthians is somewhat similar. Galatians says, Paul, an apostle, not of men, neither by man, but by Jesus Christ, and God the Father who raised him from the dead, and all the brethren which are with me. And then he addresses himself to the Galatians. Why does he introduce himself like that? And so we go down, Ephesians is Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ by the will of God. Philippians, Paul and Timotheus, the slaves of Jesus Christ. Why are they slaves when writing to the Philippians? Colossians, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ by the will of God, similar to Ephesians, and they were similar letters. When you come to Thessalonians, all he says is Paul and Silvanus and Timotheus to the Thessalonians. So all he does is use his name there. We come down to Titus, we have a reasonably lengthy one. We come to Hebrews, which is generally considered to be written by the Apostle Paul, and there is no reference to him at all. And that's very important. In fact, as Brother Carter says in his book to the Hebrews, that is probably the greatest evidence of the fact that Paul wrote Hebrews, the fact that he didn't put his name there. Because if he was going to write to Hebrews in Jerusalem, and he starts off saying, I, Paul, the Apostle to the Gentiles, write to you Hebrews, it just wouldn't have made sense. But look at Romans. Look how long the Romans one is. It goes for about six verses. So that gives you some idea of the difference between the Epistle to the Romans and all of the others. And so let's read it. We're not going to expound it. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated under the gospel of God, which he had promised before by his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, concerning his son Jesus Christ our Lord, which was made of seed of David according to the flesh, and declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness, by the resurrection from the dead, by whom we have received grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among all nations for his name, among whom are ye also the called of Jesus Christ. And then he goes on to say, to all that be in Rome. So all of those words are simply introducing himself. In fact, we haven't really even got to the salutation, because he usually then goes on to say, grace and peace be unto you. So as our title is, it's an introduction to the salutation. But look at the amount of matter that is in there as he just introduces himself. Compare that with Thessalonians, where he just says, Paul. Now, there's got to be a reason for it, doesn't there? And that's what we want to look at tonight. So we're going to do, in fact, an overview of the epistles of Paul, but then seeing the reason why the one to the Romans is so lengthy. And we're going to endeavour to see how the whole theme of the book is built in to that opening salutation. We'll have to do it in a very limited way, obviously, because to do it properly would mean you expound the whole book. So the idea would be that when we finish the book, we come back and read the first six verses again, and we say, well, can we now see a lot more in those verses than what we saw back on the 11th of February 1987? And hopefully our answer will be yes. So what we're going to expect to see out of those verses tonight will be very limited by what we would expect to see in due course. Let's, though, do an analysis of just some of these to see why Paul addressed himself in this particular way. Going back then to the Corinthians, which I think we could probably link with Ephesians and Colossians, because those four have something in common. They are the four which highlight this aspect of the will of God. He was called to be an apostle through the will of God, he told the Corinthians in the first epistle. He told them in the second epistle that he was also called by the will of God. He told the Ephesians that he was called by the will of God. And he told the Colossians that he was called by the will of God. So why was it important in writing to those particular ecclesias to emphasise that he was there in the role that he was according to the will of God? What was he going to make out of that? Well, perhaps to illustrate it, let's take Ephesians. And let's take up this expression, the will of God, as we would find it, say, in Ephesians. We turn over to the letter to the Ephesians. And we find that in the opening verse we have the salutation, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, by the will of God. And then he addresses himself to the saints. Now, what's so important then about this expression, by the will of God? Well, what you do is you look through the epistle and say, where else does it occur in the epistle? Well, we've got it again in chapter 5. Having predestinated us, and that's going to be an important sub-theme in Romans. Romans, in fact, is the key to the subject of predestination. Verse 5 of Ephesians 1 says, having... Why are you all turning pages out? Did I give you a wrong reference? Oh, thanks. Good. When you get too much rustling of paper, you know something's gone wrong. Chapter 1, verse 5. Having predestinated us unto the adoption of children by Jesus Christ to himself, according to the good pleasure of his will. Now, we see how he's starting to build up an argument. I am an apostle by the will of God. But what about you people? God has marked you out from the beginning according to the good pleasure of his will. So if it was God's will to make me an apostle, it was also God's will to mark you out. Verse 9 of chapter 1. Having made known unto us the secret of his will. So it was his will to constitute me an apostle. It was also his will that from the beginning he has marked out both Jew and Gentile that they might be children of God. But that was a secret. And that secret was not made known until when? When was the secret made known? Junior Opus Israel class. When was the secret made known? That God would call both Jew and Gentile into his house. Well, whose house was it made known in? Cornelius, that's right. the mystery of the gospel, right? But see how he's picking up this word will. I am an apostle by the will of God. Now he wants them to remember that. I'm here by the will of God, but God has marked you out according to his will. But that was a secret which was only revealed when Peter went out of the house of Cornelius and, as we would say, unlocked the key. Used the second key, rather, and unlocked the mystery of the gospel. And so this word will then becomes a key word going through the epistle. But it's all built in to his opening salutation. Chapter 5 and verse 17 is another reference to the word will. Having then moved from the doctrinal section in the first three chapters, where he establishes that not only was he an apostle by the will of God, not only were Jews and Gentiles marked out by God's will from the earliest time, not only was that a secret, the secret of God's will which had to be made known, but now he says that's got to be transferred into a way of life. And so he says in chapter 5 and verse 17, wherefore be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is. Be not drunk with wine, but do this and that and the other thing. So if God, according to his will, has predestinated, don't worry about the word for the moment, we'll deal with that in Romans, has marked us out, then he says, I expect to see a changed way of life. And so in chapter 6 and verse 6 he says, apply yourself therefore diligently in your daily occupation, verse 6, not with eye service as men pleases, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. So see how it's moved through. God's will constituted Paul an apostle. It was the will of God from the beginning that there shouldn't be a difference between Jews and Gentiles. It was the Ephesians who were doing that and calling each other names, circumcision and uncircumcision. They were splitting things up. God's will was that there would be one in Christ, one group in Christ. That will was a mystery but had been revealed by the apostles. That will must be a way of life, and that will must be seen in our daily living. So see how it all goes through, but there in the opening verse, where is it? Ephesians, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ by the will of God. And when you look at that, apart from telling us that he was an apostle, which is important enough in itself, the only other thing he says in introducing himself is that he's there by the will of God. And so that's our study of Ephesians for the night. I picked Ephesians because many are familiar with that particular book. So you can see then that when we come to study a letter of Paul, we don't just gloss over the introductory statements. They are very, very important. The thing is, we may not be able to study them properly until we finish the book. All we might be able to say is, well, I'm certain that's important. I'll watch for the importance as I go through. Let's pick up one or two others that... Galatians is an easy one. Take Galatians. In Galatians chapter 1, well, the problem he had in writing to the Galatians was that people were challenging his credentials. They were challenging him. They were saying that he hadn't learnt the truth direct from Christ, but he got it from other people, and that he wasn't really, therefore, a fully-fledged apostle. And yet he was the one that had established the truth there. And it's a very sad opening to Galatians, isn't it? Verse 6, I marvel that you are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel. There's people going around perverting the gospel. And more particularly what they were doing was they were undermining the authority of Paul. And they were saying he's not in the same rank as other apostles like Peter. And unfortunately, to prove his point, Paul had to point out to them later on that on one occasion he had to confront Peter because Peter wasn't doing the right thing. I had to confront Peter, says Paul. Now, Paul didn't want to make a big point about that. But in these ecclesias, they were saying Paul's not quite a fully-fledged apostle. So what does his opening say? It says, Paul, an apostle. And then in the English translation, they put it in brackets. I don't know how brackets appear in the Greek text. I don't think they really do. But they put it in parentheses. Not of men, neither by man, but by Jesus Christ. So he's establishing his point right from the beginning. I am an apostle. Not by men, neither by man, but by Jesus Christ. And he's going to build on that in the first two chapters. And I got it from God the Father, who raised him from the dead. So not only did he get it from Jesus, but he got it from God the Father, who raised Jesus from the dead. Why does he say, who raised him from the dead? Well, because Paul had seen the risen Lord. Paul had seen the risen Lord on the way to Damascus. And he's going to make a big point about that. He saw the risen Lord, and it was God that raised him from the dead. So if he saw the risen Lord on the way to Damascus, and that risen Lord gave Paul a message and told Paul he was going to be the apostle to the Gentiles, then that message came from God, because it was God that raised Jesus Christ from the dead. And so if the risen Lord gave him the message, it was God that raised him, therefore that message came from God. And no one could argue about Paul receiving that message on the way to Damascus. That was a historical fact which everybody knew to be true. And then he concludes by saying, and all the brethren which are with me. In other words, I'm not just some isolated second-rate apostle, as you people are trying to make out I am. I've got a whole lot of brethren here with me. So see the 3 points. I'm an apostle, not by men, but from Jesus Christ. Not merely from Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ was raised from the dead by God. Therefore, the messages come from God. And thirdly, there are lots of other brethren here with me who will endorse that. Very sad epistle when one's got to stand up, or one's got to write and say, and push their own credentials. It's an embarrassing thing to have to do, but Paul had to do it. And so the opening, therefore, was such that he laid down his credentials and he builds on them. You might just say, well, look at Thessalonians, that's an easy one. All he says is Paul. Well, what were the problems in Thessalonica? Well, Thessalonian epistles were some of the most delightful ones that you could ever want to read. There really weren't any or many obvious problems there. They loved Paul. He didn't have to introduce himself. He didn't have to tell them he was an apostle. Every chapter of both epistles speaks about the coming of the Lord. They were optimistic epistles. They were epistles that spoke about our wonderful hope. Therefore, all he did was said, Paul. But because there were two brethren with him, he joins them into the title Silvanus and Timotheus. So he doesn't have to lay down his credentials. So you see, it wasn't just flowery language that he was using. He carefully chose the words that he would use in his introductions. I think perhaps we'll take just one other. Let's take Philemon, the letter to Philemon. The letter to Philemon is only one chapter. Now, I'm going to do another one as well. I'll do Philippians as well in a minute. Let's just take Philemon, though. This is quite a unique letter, quite different from anything else that Paul wrote. A very, very personal letter where Paul bears his heart to these people, to this man, Philemon, in pleading with Philemon that he might accept back Onesimus, his runaway slave, and having accepted him back, then return him to the Apostle Paul, because the Apostle Paul could use him in a far greater work. Now the salutation is commenced in the letter to Philemon with the words, Paul, a prisoner of Jesus Christ. And of course he points out the fact that that Timothy is with him. But there it is, Paul, a prisoner of Jesus Christ. Now, we've only got 25 verses in the book. Why does he call himself a prisoner? Why is that? Well, he was a prisoner. He was in prison. But there was more to it than that. He was not only literally in prison and badly in need of help, but in another way, he was a prisoner of Jesus Christ, in the sense that he had been, if you like, captured by Jesus Christ. And that's not an uncommon expression either. But let's just take this expression, prisoner. We've got it again in verse 9. Yet for love's sake, I rather beseech thee, being such an one as Paul the aged, and now also a prisoner of Jesus Christ. And when he starts off that verse by saying, yet for love's sake, what he's saying is, I want you to accept back your runaway slave, who in his absence from you has accepted the truth from me. Now I could command you to accept him back. I could tell you, I could say, I, Paul the Apostle, tell you to take him back. But he says, I'm not doing it that way. For love's sake, I'm beseeching you, being such an one as Paul the aged and now a prisoner. So here I am in Rome, I'm a prisoner, and I'm beseeching you to accept back your runaway slave. But when you look at verses 10 and 13, you have a cognate word, which is the same as the word prisoner, just in a slightly different grammatical form. He says, I beseech thee for my son Onesimus, whom I have begotten in my bonds. So here I am bound in Rome as a prisoner. And although I'm tied up in chains, I've nevertheless brought to the birth this new child of God. I've begotten him in my bonds. And the word bonds there is, to all intents and purposes, the same as the word prisoner. Just a slightly different grammatical form of the word. But verse 13 says, whom I would have retained with me, that in thy stead he might have ministered unto me in the bonds of the gospel. So from being a prisoner in literal bonds in Rome, and in those bonds, in those chains, he is able to beget a child. It's also, in a mild way, perhaps a rebuke against Philemon himself, because this person had worked for Philemon and all he'd done was run away. Comes over to Rome, Paul converts him to the truth, sends him back to Philemon and says, Philemon, take him back now as a brother, but what I want you to do is send him back because I can use him in Rome. But the literal bonds of Paul the prisoner in Rome now become the bonds of the gospel of verse 13. So from a literal bond, he's now going to develop a spiritual bond. And there it is, all built into the title. The important word, therefore, in the epistle to Philemon is the word prisoner. It's one thing to be a prisoner in Rome, to be a prisoner of Jesus Christ, but there are the bonds of the gospel, and we're all bound into the gospel. We're all prisoners to the gospel. We're chained to that gospel. All right, again, it's just built into the title. One other, let's just take Philippians, because this is also a very important one. Paul and Timotheus, the slaves of Jesus Christ. So there's the title this time. Not a prisoner, a slave. Not an apostle, not there by the will of God, he's a slave. Why is he pointing out that he's a slave? Well, because he wants to speak about another slave and others who should also be slaves. Philippians chapter 2, verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being the manifestation of God, the morphe, in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, not the best translation, but it will do for the moment, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon himself the manifestation of a slave. And having been made in the likeness of men, and being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And so there was the greatest man that ever lived, and he was a slave. Well, what about you people, he says. He says, well, you know, don't do things through vainglory. Develop a lowliness of mind. Part of the problem with the Philippians was that they were elevating themselves above their brethren. Slaves can't elevate themselves. Slaves are in effect non-persons. They weren't even regarded as human beings in the Roman Empire. They were merely chattel. And Paul starts off his epistle to the Philippians by saying, Paul and Timotheus, we're slaves. That's what we are. And yet in another place, Paul would boast that he was a free man. But not to the Philippians. Paul says, I'm a slave. Timothy's a slave. The greatest slave of all was Jesus Christ. And what are you people doing? You people are going around doing things through strife and vainglory. And where's strife and vainglory, brethren and sisters, when we're all down at the grassroots level, when we can't get down any lower? So you see, the aspect of being a servant or being a slave comes through very powerfully. I think that will do us. But for those who perhaps haven't studied Paul's epistles very much, and as I look around, there's a lot of young ones here, some newly baptised in the truth, maybe haven't looked at many of Paul's epistles, this would be, therefore, I believe, a very good and important starting point for any of the epistles of Paul, which, after all, constitute a very large section of the New Testament writings. Some of the older young ones are wanting to get into Timothy because the epistles to Timothy have been done by the young ones recently, and they might like to add some points on that. Well, I don't think we'll spend time on that at the moment. We'll go on to Romans. But does anybody want to add anything or ask anything about anything we've said on that general overview? All right, well, we assume that then gives us the okay to head into Romans itself. Which takes us back then to Romans chapter 1. The opening verse says, Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated unto the gospel of God. I just mention at this stage that there will be one other set of notes, I think, which we will hand out to you. For what they are worth, you can have access to them. And they are some photocopies of the marking I've got here, so that if you do miss some verses, or if I don't get time to put them in, you can see at least what I'm referring to in my margin. They are not to be taken as being certainly not inspired, but you know, they're my notes. So for what those notes are worth, it may be helpful if you've got them, and hopefully by next class we'll have this first page reproduced. So if you don't get down all of the quotes tonight, and if there's some I don't have time to give, we will be handing them out, all being well, next time. So when we look at this opening verse, we've got Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated unto the gospel of God. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Here he starts off by describing himself as a slave. And yet he's the very one that would boast in the fact that he was a free Roman citizen. But you see, writing to a person in Rome, Roman citizenship would be very, very important. Paul makes it very clear then that he's not boasting in his citizenship. As far as he's concerned, yes, he was a free-born Roman, but he was a slave of Jesus Christ. So we will watch then, won't we, for the way in which this aspect of the Paul the slave, Paul the servant, comes out in the book. And it would be very foolish tonight to try and exhaust all of the things we're going to see here, because it really involves the whole study of the book. So we'll simply note that there again he is calling himself a slave, and there will be reasons, of course, as to why we'll need to note that later on. He was called to be an apostle. Well, that's a fairly common sort of title. He's going to tell us in the Epistle to the Romans that his role as an apostle was very important. He says, as far as I'm concerned, I see myself in two situations. There is Paul the man, and there is Paul the apostle. As far as Paul the apostle is concerned, I magnify my office. And when I'm talking to you as an apostle, I am the most important apostle to the Gentiles. You've got to take my word for it. But when you're talking about Paul the man and my ability to live up to the truth, I had a dreadful job. I've got a war going on inside of me all the time. The flesh is fighting against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. My mind says do one thing, and my flesh does something else. That's me, Paul the man. But Paul the apostle, when I'm speaking as an apostle, you listen to what I say, because that's the office which has been given to me. I've been called to be an apostle, and I've been separated unto the gospel of God. And so there is the dual role of the man. Paul the man, Paul the apostle. And brethren and sisters, it's really the same today, isn't it? None of us are apostles, but many of us do minister in ecclesial life, on the platform, off the platform. We all endeavour to allow the Word of God to speak in us. And yet all of us speak things which we know that we don't manage to do in our lives. Well, that's just because we are what we are. That doesn't mean to say we're not trying to do it. Unfortunately, of course, there are times when human beings make capital of people's weakness. And they did that about Paul, didn't they? It wasn't the Romans, it was the Philippians that said that his speech was weak and Campbell. Was it the Philippians?
Corinthians
said that. They said, look, you know, you listen to him talk, he can't even put his words together properly. Oh, he can write letters all right. The Galatians said he's only a second-rate apostle, he learned it from somebody else. You see, when the truth hits home and demands certain standards, people will very often turn around and say, yeah, that's all right for him, but look what he does. And so we do, don't we, have to separate between Norm Lloyd, the chairman, who is leading us in our meeting, and Norm Lloyd, the hairdresser, whatever he does in his life. But this is it, isn't it? We don't magnify a person's weakness in order to discount something which comes from their mouth which we know happens to be true. We may even feel the people are hypocrites. Well, that's something that God will determine. But it's very important. We've got to realise that there are these two roles. And so you see, Paul is a slave of Jesus Christ. He's going to show to us how he has become enslaved to this new power. He was once upon a time enslaved to King Sin. But he's now enslaved to Christ. And we're not going to develop that theme tonight, but that's the way it's going to go through Romans. How he's changed his masters. Once upon a time it was his master, King Sin. Now it is Jesus Christ that he is enslaved to. You see how Christ is being elevated? We might say, oh, we're slaves to God. Yes, we are slaves to God, but as we go through this epistle, we're going to see how Jesus Christ does perform an important role. We're opposed to the idea of praying to Jesus. We're very cautious in the way in which we sing hymns to Jesus. Some may be acceptable, some may be unacceptable, because we don't want to make Jesus God. But at the same time, Jesus is the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, and therefore we want to see him in that full power of the complete role. And Paul's going to do that for us in Romans. So, implicit in this opening verse, Paul can say, here I am Paul, I'm now a slave of Jesus Christ, no longer a slave of sin, because I've been called to be an apostle. But me, Paul the man, well, I'm still sinning. And so we're going to have to watch that dual role as he elevates his position as an apostle, a slave of Jesus Christ, no longer to King Sin, but in his own life, he has real problems every day with sin, and he's going to help us to also overcome as he was enabled to overcome through the power of the Word. He was separated unto the gospel of God. And so Paul was able to see the way in which the divine hand in his life had shaped his course of life. So he was separated unto the gospel of God. We could pick up actually that word called if we went through. Let's have a look at that word called before we go on to separated. Paul could say in verse 1 that he was called an apostle. Or if you like, he was a called apostle. In verse 6 he says, among whom are ye also the called of Jesus Christ. So you see how he's going to build up his argument. I've been called, but you also have been called. Verse 7, to all that be in Rome, beloved of God, called to be saints. So Paul had been called to be an apostle. All these other people had been called, even if it might have been in a different sort of way. They'd been called to be saints. And of course, by the time we get to chapter 8, and just let's look at it for the record and not attempt to expound it, he says in chapter 8 and verse 28, and we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. So you see, what it could be a good idea to do, and I haven't actually done this myself, but I have in a sort of way mentally, but I haven't documented it, might be to say, pick up that word call and say, I'm going to watch the way in which he develops the called theme through the gospel. I'm called as an apostle. You've been called. You've been called to be saints. And then when you get to chapter 8, he explains how the calling takes place. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son. And he deals with the way in which it all happens. Separated unto the gospel of God. The word separated there. It's a word which only occurs once in the epistle, but it's very similar to another word which is going to occur later on, and which we've already referred to. The Greek word for separated is apharizo, A-P, and then you've got horizo. It's like the word horizon, except without an N on it. The word horizon in English means that line that you see when you go down to the beach, where the sky finishes and the sea starts. It doesn't just mean that when the sun's going down, it's going down over the horizon. That's a limited use of the word. The word horizo actually means to mark out. It's a mark. And it's that line that you see there, which is actually the horizon. So if you've got ap in front of it, ap horizo, which literally means from mark out, then you've actually separated somebody. You've marked them out and you've removed them. You've separated them. If you put, say, pro in front of the word horizo, which means before, then it means you've marked them out before. And that's the word normally translated predestinated. Don't worry about it for the moment. We'll come to that in due course. So this word horizo means to mark out. You can get aphorizo, which means I've separated them. You can get prohorizo, which means I've marked them out before. But built into this word separated is going to be a powerful theme which reaches its peak in Romans chapter 8. So what is he saying here? He's saying in this opening verse that he's a slave. He's a slave of Jesus Christ now. He used to be a slave to sin. Didn't say it in that verse, but that's what he's going to say later on in the book. He's been called to be an apostle. But later on in the book he's going to say, I'm not the only one that's been called, you've been called. And you want to know the process of calling? I'll explain it to you. This is how God's calling takes place. That's going to become a theme. I've been separated under the gospel of God. God has marked me out and taken me and put me over here. But he's marked you out before as well. He's marked you out, pro horizo. And so these are words which will be taken up. Verse 2. Oh, sorry, no, we haven't finished verse 1 yet. We mustn't run away from it. What's he been separated unto? He's been separated unto the gospel of God. Well, now, I seem to be saying every couple of minutes this is an important theme in the book. Well, there are lots of important themes, and that's what makes the book of Romans profound. There's just so many themes in it. But you must listen to this one, because this is the theme of the book. The theme of the book is the gospel of God. The gospel of God. So he had been separated. He'd been marked out to a way of life which required conformity to a pattern of life which God showed in his Son. All of this is involved in the term the gospel of God. But what's the gospel of God all about? We're looking at our chart here. The gospel of God starts up here with the invisible I will be. But in order for that gospel of God to become visible, it has to be manifested through the visible who I will be. And so the theme develops. When we come to verse 9, the gospel of God now becomes, for God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son. So the gospel of God means that the invisible in creation, I will be, of Exodus chapter 3, has got good news. But for that good news to be manifested, it has to come through a visible who I will be. So it becomes now the gospel of his son in verse 9. And by the time we get to verse 16, he says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ." Now this is the point we're making. Whilst God will always be the pinnacle of everything in the truth, in this particular letter, Paul elevates Jesus Christ to his rightful place. And the rightful place is that as the who I will be, he is just as much God as the I will be. Now you know what we mean, don't you, by that? He's not co-equal, co-eternal, anything like that. But he is the manifestation of the invisible. Therefore, as we go through this epistle, we're going to be looking at Christ. The gospel of Christ is exactly the same as the gospel of God. But God's invisible, Christ is visible. Therefore, Christ is going to become to us a visible personality, a way of life, a real human being, who at this present moment is our mediator in heaven, interceding on our behalf. And we mustn't leave him out in our thinking and just treat him as a concept or some sort of adjunct which is there, but we're not really quite sure what to do with him, how to treat him, and how to relate to him. And from time to time, all of us become a little bit confused as to, well, particularly our hymn book, as to what sort of hymns are appropriate. And there are some that are inappropriate, and some of them have got into our hymn book over the years, probably taken out of a church hymn book or something. But the fact of the matter is, we want to endeavour during the course of our studies to elevate Christ to his rightful position. And so then, when we come to verse 3, because we don't have to say a lot about verse 2, verse 2 says that this gospel was promised before by his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. And because that's in brackets, you see, we can almost dash straight on to verse 3. So let's read, if you like, verses 1 and 3 and leave out verse 2, because that then allows the theme to flow through more smoothly. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated under the gospel of God, concerning his son. And most other translations leave out the word Jesus Christ our Lord. Doesn't matter whether they're left out or not, because that's who he was. But some texts leave it out. Concerning his son, which was made of the seed of David according to the flesh. So that's one side of him. And declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead. Now he said, we want to see Jesus Christ in this twofold role. We want to see him as seed of David and Son of God with power. Now, I had hoped to deal with both of these tonight, but I suspect we're only going to really have time to deal with the first one, and that is the seed of David. Now, as we read through books like this, we've got to keep asking ourselves questions. Why does Paul say this? Now, if we want to present the twofold aspect of Christ, and we've got him as Christ the man and Christ the God, or the manifestation of God, if we were going to describe him as Christ the man, what do we say? He was made of the seed of Adam, because in Romans chapter 5 he does say that Jesus Christ was a descendant of Adam. He could say he was the seed of the woman. He could say he was the seed of Abraham. He could say he was the seed of David. He's got a whole range of choices. But why does he select David in this particular context? Well, again, the answer is true that we must study the rest of Romans to find out. But what we can do is to do just a little study on the title Seed of David, or if you like, Son of David. There are several titles of the Lord: Son of God, Son of Man, Son of David. The one in relationship to Son of David is one that's not quite so familiar, but here is a summary, as I see it, of the significance of the title Son of David. And on this transparency, we set out here the way in which the three dominant titles, Son of God, Son of Man, and Son of David, are used, particularly in the Gospels and in the other relevant New Testament writings. So it reads that the title, Son of David, as distinct from either Son of God, representing his power. So we're not expounding that. All we're saying is whenever you come across the title Son of God, it always has to do with power. Power in the sense of strength. It's the Son of God who raises the dead. Not the Son of David and not the Son of Man. The title Son of Man represents authority. So it's the Son of Man that is going to judge those who are raised from the dead. And we can give you references to prove this as needed. Just one word of caution for those who may not have looked at this. In the Authorised Version of the Bible, the word authority is unfortunately sometimes translated as power. It might be a good Bible marking exercise sometimes to go through and distinguish between the word dunamos, meaning power, as in, you know, dynamics and dynamite and all of those English words we get from dunamos, which means power. So if there was an explosion outside there, you would say that was power. As against the word authority, which is the Greek word exousios, but sometimes unfortunately translated as power. But once you've got those sorted out, the rule is totally constant, that Son of God is the one who raises the dead, Son of Man is the one who judges them. Well, what about David? The title Son of David is associated with his right to the throne of David. But this right is not merely legal due to genealogical inheritance. In other words, it's not just because you can read in Matthew chapter 1 that Jesus descended from David, therefore he was the seed of David. No, it's more than that. It is also moral because of the qualities of character he manifested. And so the title, Son of David, has moral attributes as well. In fact, there is one specific moral attribute which is associated with the title, Son of David, and, as it goes on to say, the title is virtually always associated with mercy, and is doubtless connected with such Old Testament passages as those listed below there. 2 Samuel 7:15, 1 Kings 3:6, 2 Chronicles 1:8, 6 verse 14 and verse 42, and quite a few of the Psalms, and Isaiah 55 verse 3. To illustrate this, just take for example the use of the title Son of David found in the Gospel of Matthew. Here are all the occurrences of the title Son of David found in the Gospel of Matthew. Chapter 1, verse 1, the generation of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. Son of David is the very first title he uses. Chapter 9, verse 27, thou son of David, have mercy on us. 12, verse 23, is not this the son of David? And in the context, the statement was, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. They were arguing about this point of sacrifice. The Lord says, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. After he had convinced them of this, they said, is not this the Son of David? Chapter 15, verse 22, have mercy on me, O Lord, thou Son of David. Chapter 20, verse 30, have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. Chapter 20, verse 31, have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. Chapter 21, verse 9, Hosanna to the Son of David. Chapter 21, verse 15, Hosanna to the Son of David. Chapter 22, verse 42, Messiah, whose son is he? They say, Son of David. And it was also used of Joseph in chapter 1, verse 20, where Joseph agreed to take Mary, his wife. In other words, he extended mercy in taking her, and he is styled also a son of David. So you see, in all of those references there, the word mercy is quite a predominant word. That's why we talk about the sure mercies of David. Well, what we're going to have to watch for then, when we go through the Epistle to the Romans, is the significance of this particular word mercy. And so when we come across the statement here in Romans chapter 1 and verse 3, that he was made of the seed of David according to the flesh, what we're going to see is that here is one who inherited the title Son of David. So that just as Son of Man doesn't simply mean that he was a descendant of Adam, but it means more particularly that he inherited the title because he had the dominion over the flesh. And Son of God doesn't just mean that God was his father, but that he showed forth the moral attributes of his father. So the title Son of David is not merely his legal right to the throne, but his moral right to the throne, because that throne is going to be established in mercy. So that by the time we get to chapter 12, verse 1, the very first verse of what we will call the practical section of the epistle, he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. And so when he gets to the practical section, the moral section if you like, the first word he says, I beseech you by the mercies of God. Now all of that was built into the title, Seed of David, right back in chapter 1 and verse 3. Now I hope, brethren and sisters, you can see what I've endeavoured to do tonight. I've tried not to go too far into the book, but just to lay the seeds of saying this opening salutation is going to be important. And really what we have to do, of course, is that God willing, in due course, when we finish the book, as a summary, probably the best thing we can do is just slowly read Romans chapter 1, verses 1 to 6, and you'll say, oh, there's the theme of chapter 9, there's the theme of this, and there's the theme of that. So what we've looked at then up to this point would be the key words in the salutation, but we've looked at what we might say is one side of the character of the Lord Jesus Christ, that is, as the seed of David according to the flesh. Now, being as he is the seed of David according to the flesh, that of course indicates to us that he is the one that has manifested in his life those moral attributes, particularly the attribute of mercy. The mercy of God is shown forth in its greatest sense in the gospel, and that's why the gospel can be called the sure mercies of David. God willing, in our next class, we're going to take up the theme of verse 4. Declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead. If you get the opportunity, I'd like you to look at that verse very carefully. Perhaps compare it with some other translations, because there are two alternative translations of this verse. The end result doesn't really differ. But there are good arguments for these two different translations. If you do get the opportunity to pick this up and have a look at it, I'm sure it'll make the next class more interesting, because we're going to see the way in which Paul says that Jesus Christ was declared, and of course here comes our word horizo again, he was declared to be the Son of God. How was he declared to be the Son of God? Well, three ways. With power, according to the Spirit of holiness, and by the resurrection from the dead. It's essentially that expression with power that is the one that's a little bit debatable in different translations. And we won't deal with that at this time. So I think it would be appropriate if we leave it at that point.